What's up, bookworms? Welcome to episode 148 of the Cantina Book Club podcast, where readers can find interviews with authors of all genres. I'm Megan, self-proclaimed Cantina Queen, here to bring you insights from the authors themselves. Each week features a Cantina conversation with an author, sometimes they're returning guests, and sometimes it's someone new. Please be sure to hit that subscribe button so that you never miss out on an episode, and feel free to browse through existing episodes so that you can catch a previous interview about a book that you finished. Today's episode features a chat with Carrie Mayer talking about her book Summer of Love. That book is available now. This was such a meaningful, powerful, and entertaining book, and the chat was just as much so. I really appreciated Carrie's openness and authenticity, vulnerability. She opened up about her own sobriety journey, how her life experiences helped her to develop the story that features these three women, and a story about, you know, substance abuse, addiction, recovery, sobriety, and really meaningful story. We started off the chat with a demonstration of a Summer of Love mocktail recipe. So keep an eye out for that video, whether or not it comes out before this episode comes out. You'll just have to keep an eye on Cantina Book Club social media for that. But it was such a delicious drink, and it was so fun. It does taste like summer, and I'd give it to anybody. My kids loved it. So, you know, you can always count on that. Now, some spoilers might pop up in these conversations, but the episode is more enjoyable if you've read the book anyway. So if you don't know why I'm kind of tiptoeing around a certain subject matter in terms of this dark, the demons, the dark secrets that family finds himself in, hit pause, add this episode to your playlist, and go pick up a copy of Summer of Love. The interview will be here when you're ready. Just a heads up that I often use adult language to express my feelings towards these authors and their work. And sometimes these episodes do contain some sensitive subject matter, content, trigger warnings. So just please be mindful around your comfort level and around listening ears. But without further ado, get ready, grab your favorite drink. Here is Carrie. Today we've got Carrie Mayer. We're talking about her book, Summer of Love, that comes out on July 7th. Carrie, thank you so much for joining me today. And I'm so excited that we're doing a complimentary mocktail to go with your Summer of Love. Thanks. I'm excited to do it with me. Thanks for being such a good sport and willing to participate in this idea. And I'm really excited to not only dig deeper, but try this delicious recipe.
Me too. I'm going to be sipping it while we have our chat. But first we're going to make it, right? So here we go. Mm-hmm. I'm going to follow your lead a little bit here. I've got my fancy glass.
I did. I came prepared. I got the salt and the lime.
I've already done the prep, right? Like I've got watermelon and juiced lime, but I'm going to prep the glass. I'll prep the glass. So we're going to do lime juice around the edge of the glass. And then we got a little dish of kosher salt here, and I'm going to, this is like doing a margarita or a macarita.
The macarita. I love that.
Okay. So I have, and this is my cute little lime wedge. So here we are with the prep. Here we
Perfect.
Go. Okay. So the recipe, and people can see a picture of this recipe on my Instagram. It's on a little postcard, and actually people can get this postcard if they order a signed copy of my book from Wellesley Books, which is my local indie, and they're including those postcards. So here we have chunks of watermelon, and I'm making like a half recipe here because it's just me here, it's me and the dog here tonight. So, and then I have this simple syrup that I made last night. So I've got like about a quarter of a cup. I'm not even going to use that much because I prefer tart drinks to drinks. So, and then.
Okay. So you're saying if someone likes it a little sweeter, maybe put more of the like ratio.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And I'm going to add a little more lime juice than maybe they suggested. Are you like a precision cooker? Cause I'm not, I'm like a.
If I'm doing something new, I am, but it depends on certain recipes. Like if I've done it like a million times, I just eyeball it like guacamole. My mom's recipe, I've made it a million times. So I just do what feels right. If it's new, I usually do try my best to follow as it is. So you combined, you did the chunks and the lime juice and the simple syrup all together.
Yep, all in
in the blender?
All in the blender.
Okay, perfect. That actually might help it mix a little bit better too. Okay. All right.
Okay. All right. On the count of three, we're going to make a lot of noise.
Yes, I'm going to do this. Okay. Got this. Got this. Now, do you blend it on low or high?
I blend everything on, there's one, two, and three. I do everything on three.
Okay. Got it. Perfect. All right. Ready?
All right. One, two, three. Anything else that people can do like I did, I added a little bit more watermelon because it was slushy enough and because I wanted a little bit more slushy. So okay. I added more watermelon. So that's, again, you can just make it work for you.
Pouring it in. And then I didn't bring any ice in mine. I didn't. So I guess that's an option, that's an right? Option.
Like, the ice is an option. It's true.
Okay. Oh, it looks Woo! So cute. Yay.
Cheers.
That's so refreshing. It tastes like summer.
It totally does taste like summer. I see.
Summer of love.
Summer watermelon love. Oh, I like, I don't know if you're getting any of the salt, but I really like the salt as a counterpoint to the sweet.
Oh, I have a straw, yeah. Actually. Let me. That is good. Yeah.
All right.
So yeah, it was smart of us to try to just do half the recipe because even after, like, I still got a good amount left after pouring my kids a couple drinks. That's what I also appreciate about doing mocktails because it's like I can give it to my kids. I can share it with everybody. Yeah. But yeah, no, good. Okay. Right. Perfect. Yep. Thank you for doing that. Okay. So now, yay, this is delicious. Tastes like summer.
I am adding some ice and a straw, so.
Yeah, good idea. I'm okay with this being like on the room temperature side, but maybe like when I make another batch, maybe I'll try with some ice for sure. Nice. Okay. So to get started, can you share, like, you said you wanted to be spoiler free. So can you share a summary of Summer of Love so that people can follow along with the conversation?
Yeah, sure. I have to just caveat this and say, I do not have a great elevator speech for this book. Like, this is, I think, the shortest possible version is it's a family secrets novel set on the California coast in San Francisco and on a Napa Valley winery. Okay, so that's a super short version. The longer version is it's a dual timeline novel, one of which stays in 2015, so it feels pretty contemporary. And the other one starts in 1967 with the Summer of Love in San Francisco. This is like the beginning of the counterculture revolution, the free speech movement, all the anti-war protests, the hippies and the Haight-Ashbury, all those things that you know about with when you think about San Francisco in the 60s, this is the summer of all of that, that where all of that really started. So, and the main character in the 2015 storyline is Dawn, who is the daughter of Miranda, who by 2015, she's like this famous female vintner. Like, she's one of the first female vintners in Napa. She was really in the forefront of the California, this sort of mid-century California wine movement. She makes really high-end bottles of wine, right? So she's like famous. But Dawn, this is not a spoiler, is struggling with her drinking. And so she's got a lot of, that's like one of the big secrets. Like, she's really keeping the secret to herself. She cannot figure out how to tell her mother this. Her mother, who, although she makes wine, hardly drinks at all. Because really, winemaking for her is the art and science of it. It's not really about drinking it. So we contrast that to, so then we go, the 1967 storyline follows Miranda as a younger woman and her sister, Winnie. So Winnie is like more of a free spirit. Like, while Miranda is up in Napa in the lab trying to figure out how to make California wine that rivals French wine, Winnie has just graduated from college from UC Berkeley. She's moved across the bay to San Francisco. She wants to be a poet. So she's participating in the war protests. She's writing for magazines and newspapers and working as a copy editor and working on her poetry. She also reconnects with a high school boyfriend, and it is very hot between them. So,
yeah. I just really enjoyed getting to know the family, and also just you weren't afraid to go there with the serious themes and just the struggles, like real human struggles that I imagine a lot of your readers might relate. And it, because it's like, it's, this is life, and it's, life is heartbreaking, but it also is a story, like, when I was reflecting on it, I was like love is the driving force, and how that can just help like heal you, that can help you forgive, that can help just love yourself and move forward and carry on and just like accept yourself as you are and then work on yourself, like following that. And it's just, it was just so powerful. I loved getting to know your characters and just you made me feel things. And it's just, it was like a package, like cut through us in it. And then, but like you gave us a hug at the end, like it's all right.
I love that. I love that. A hug at the end. That was my intention. Yeah, life is hard. Life gets really lifey, and it's hard, and people go through a lot of stuff to get to better off, very often get to better places. Like, I'm not going to be completely unrealistic here, right? Like, there are some people who don't meet happy endings, but I really wanted to show how the ways in which a few different types of struggles can result in real joy and real triumph at the end, right? Like Dawn is struggling with her drinking. Readers are going to see her go through that process. She's actually, when the novel opens, she has just stopped drinking. She's like right around at the 6 month mark, but she's not really convinced mm-hmm. that sobriety is for her. She can't even bring herself to use the word. And she has this like BFF from college, Audrey, who has been sober for like 8 years or something like that. So they talk a lot about it in this like sort of fun, modern, irreverent way. So I wanted to, and I wanted to be able to talk about addiction and recovery in modern terms as, and that was one of the reasons why I knew that this book was always going to have a dual timeline. I couldn't make completely contemporary work with the ages of all the characters. Like it really, I didn't want Dawn to be much older than she is in the book. She's right around 40 years old in the book. And due to events, she couldn't be 40 years old and have it be later than 2015. So anyway.
Yeah. No, I think it's also a little bit refreshing. I'm going to be 40 in February. And so it like, as a reader of a lot of contemporaries and just like a lot of different genres, it's refreshing to have an older main character. And even because even like in Miranda and Winnie's lives, their points of view, we follow them for like, what, 9 years or something like that, like 10 years, something. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So where them grow up, and then from Dawn's point of view, she or not grow up. And then Dawn's point of view, she's the idea is that she's already a grown up, but she's still like the readers can see. Oh, like she's still figuring shit out. Like she's still figuring things out and herself. And I think, one of the most like powerful things with her inner turmoil is because if she says the word, that makes it real. If she tells her mom the truth, that means it's real. Yep. And she's still like, she's not ready for that realness. She's not ready for that reality to like really admit it. She knows it. Mm-hmm. But she's like, And I think that's just like, it's such a unique and powerful way to present that, like without being too preachy about it. Cause you weren't like forcing sobriety down our throats, but you kind of like, we're like, no, this is her story. This is their journey. It's also like mental health and the things, the choices that people make that have a ripple effect across like, you know, down the line, like around them and then down the line generations. Yes. Like I felt for everybody. I was rooting for all of them. Like even the questionable decisions, like even their mom, I think was Joan. I was like, she's a little problematic, but it's okay.
Joan is, everyone is a person of their time. Also, when you write historical fiction, I think one of the great challenges is to write characters who can be problematic and are products of their time. But also you do want your modern readers often, not all the time, but often to be rooting for them, right? You want them.
Yeah.
And so that's a difficult balance to strike. And thank goodness for multiple drafts and readers who will read my drafts and give me comments and all of that good stuff.
I was going to ask one of the questions I always like to ask, because you've got quite a few published works.
Mm-hmm. This is my fifth published novel.
Well done. I love it. And I kind of want to explore, like, how did you approach this project versus your previous works? And like, any big lessons learned, any surprising things that you learned about anything and stuff like that?
Yeah. So this is a pretty big departure. So I've been slowly moving away from what we might call biographical fiction. So my first three published historical novels were about real people. There was the Kennedy Debutante, which was about Kathleen Kennedy, who was with John F. Kennedy's, one of his younger sisters, on the eve of and during World War II. The second novel was about Grace Kelly. And then the third novel was called The Paris Bookseller. It was about the original Shakespeare and Company bookstore in Paris in the 20s that was opened by this American woman named Sylvia Beach. So all the main characters in those books were real people. The secondary characters were pretty much all real people also. Like in The Paris Bookseller, Hemingway was a secondary character, which was super, which was
Yeah.
I mean, and it was, I always like to say that it was good that I got to practice with John F. Kennedy first, because I think that if I had tried to do Hemingway first, I might have just given up.
Anyway,
so my last novel, All You Have to Do Is Call, was a departure, the first departure, in that all the characters in All You Have to Do Is Call were fictional. So I was no longer dealing with real people, but those characters were loosely based on a real group of women, the Jane Collective of Chicago in the early 70s, who ran an underground women's reproductive health clinic in the years before Roe. So though, again, my characters are not the real women of Jane, but it was rooted in the real history of Jane. And I used a lot of milestone dates that were true to the original group of women and all that stuff. We're moving further away from writing about real people. So in Summer of Love, all the characters are fictional again. And the only real, the thing that makes it historical fiction is that one of the timelines starts in 1967 against this like very real, well-known backdrop of San Francisco and Napa in the 60s through into the 70s, right? So that's what makes it historical fiction or a dual timeline. But it is really different from my previous books. Something else that I realized as I was talking about this book recently is that those first four novels also, I got those ideas from like the world. I got the idea for All You Have to Do Is Call by listening. I heard about the Jane Collective on an NPR news story. So like that idea came to me. This book came from inside me. So I was actually, after All You Have to Do Is Call, I was like trying to figure out what I wanted to write next. I was very lucky that my publisher wanted me for another book. And so I was trying to figure it out. And there weren't any real people that I wanted to write about. And I was really struggling a little bit. And a friend of mine told me to do the artist's way. Have you ever done the artist's way? Do you know what the artist's way is?
Maybe in this context, so, I can get it, but please explain.
12-week creativity course in a book. You can purchase it at any book called The Artist's Way. And it's by a woman named Julia Cameron. And it is magic. Like, it is highly endorsed by the likes of Elizabeth Gilbert. Okay. So who has done the artist's way like numerous times, she says. So anyway, I had been avoiding The Artist's Way for years because I knew that the cornerstone of The Artist's Way, or the foundation of it, was these things called morning pages, which is a journaling practice, a morning journal. And I do not like to journal. I am not a journaler. I really thought that, but I was like, okay, I was desperate. So I was like, I'm going to do it. And I'll tell you, within weeks, maybe 4-ish weeks of doing those morning pages and the other exercises in the book, the whole novel sort of came together in my mind. So, we try things when we are up against it and they often work. Like The Artist worked for me and journaling really worked for me. So
I love that. 'Cause I did do it for a while, but I think I felt like maybe an obligation to keep up with it. And it's like, well, before I knew it, I was going in like weeks in between entries. And plus it was during a time where I was like really struggling with my mental health. And I was trying like all these different things to see like what would help and just figure out like that special sauce that would really just help. And because I've been dealing with depression and anxiety for like, God, I think I first brought it up to my mom when I was like 13 or 14. And still it's like, I've been in and out of therapies, in and out of like off of meds and all that. And I finally, as an adult, I was like, okay, like, let's see, I have to still try to figure this out. I like took a break from figuring it out. And then I didn't. And especially because I have like two boys, elementary school age. And so when I just remember when I was like when I was pregnant with the second one, it was like really, it was just like hitting me so hard. I think just with all the hormones and everything. And luckily I was able to narrow it down. Like, okay, I got this person who I'm going to go to. I've been going to the same therapist for like maybe 5 years now. And she's great. She's hilarious. She's from Poland. So she's got that like blunt European delivery. And it's just really, she just vibes. It's really funny that she's, yeah, she's just to the point. Like, she cares about you, but she's like, you know what? She's like, what do you think this is going to be like? Like, you got to do this and that. And then, yeah, I found a good medication combination that just, yeah, it's like journaling, all these like practices. I was reading self-help books, which I've never done before, because I was like, what, yeah, you know, like, what can I take away from this? And so, yeah, I appreciate that you were like, you know what, fine. And then it ended up working out really well for you. You got a whole like a meaningful story about it out of
love that you share and are so open about your mental health journey. So really, that's such an important thing. I've had my own. I've been in therapy my whole adult life, basically. Like, I have taught a lot of writing in my day. I'm not currently teaching, but I very often would say, like, a therapist is a writer's best friend. Like, writers need, there's no shame in therapy, and in fact, you should just think about getting one proactively.
It's really like, even if like we all like our like health is also mental, and it's like, even if you don't have like severe problems, it's still your mental health. Like, it's just like, just for a tune up. You don't have to have anything major going on. You could just go, they're ready for you.
And I know couples who just get a couples therapist. So have one on tap.
Yeah.
You know what hits the fan. And listen,
absolutely.
I'm also, part of the reason I was interested in the recovery sort of addiction, the drinking and recovery storyline, is because I am myself sober. I had my own journey, and that it is in the end a mental health journey. That
is a mental health journey.
There's a reason why I think pretty much everyone who's using some kind of substance, it's some version of self-medication, right? Like, what, like, once you get rid of the thing, the substance, you get the fun part, which is to figure out why you were doing it in the first place.
Just like, make yourself feel things and figure it out.
Oh, you mean I feel my feelings.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Congrats on sobriety. That's like a huge, it's a huge thing. It's a big accomplishment. And also just to keep it going, because I know there's plenty of people who are successful with it, but then still relapse sometimes. It's hard, but it's just like, okay, like, just take one day at a time. And like, my cousin's, God, I think she's been sober for like 8 years now. And she, one thing that she would, which you've incorporated also, you pointed out with Dawn's inner monologue, where that I found, like, I knew that my cousin struggled with, is like the social situations where it's like, Dawn is considering seeing a male friend, like a budding interest, and like, naturally he's like, do you want to go out for a drink? And she's just like, oh God damn it, like, there it is. And that's one thing my cousin realized, where it was like, did she stop, she learned, like, well, she stopped getting invited to certain places because she wasn't drinking anymore. And she would figure out a way to, if she was going to a social situation where people were drinking at a bar, she would just find a way to like let the bartender know, like, hey, I'm sober, do you think you can just like do this or whatever? And they're like, she figured it out. But I know that's one of the things that she noticed, was like, drinking is just such a huge part of just social gatherings, and to try to just have that strength to be able to like be around it or just not, it is a big deal. And so I have appreciation and respect for anybody who finds a way to do that and to keep going with it. Or even if they struggle with it, even if they have a couple of shortcomings or fallbacks, should say, and it's still like, it's part of the journey.
It's 100% part of the journey. It's not, progress is never linear on anything. And 8 years ago, she did not, that would have been hard, much harder. We're now living in like a golden age of non-alcoholic. Like, most restaurants have at least 3 or 4 interesting mocktail options.
Yeah.
Non-alcoholic beer. I'm increasingly seeing non-alcoholic wine. True purists are like, you should not be having the beer, the non-alcoholic beer or wine. I am not one of those purists, but like, because it's also not triggering for me. Mm. I love a good non-alcoholic beer with some French fries on a hot day.
Yeah, it's something about it. Yeah,
and
it's a good pairing.
It is exactly. But alcohol is, as this, I am not the first person to say this, many people have said it, it is the only drug you have to justify not taking.
Yeah, I know, right? Because I'm thinking, like, that's so wild to look at it that way. Because it's true. Yeah. It's just like, oh, you don't drink? Like, why? It's like, what does it matter? Like, because,
yeah.
Like, do you really want to go there? Like,
the other great thing about, like, this, like I said, the golden age of mocktails is that, like, you can have these days, you can have something that looks like a drink. Like, it's a drink. No one would know. Yeah. No one has to know what's in this. You're not necessarily carrying around iced tea or a Diet Coke or whatever, which sometimes would invite questions. Although I find that, and as a lot of people find when they stop drinking, no one cares. The people who care are often the people who are often also struggling.
Like, it's, yeah, I even think, like, there were things, like, there, maybe there was, like, activities where I was, like, thinking about, like, I think it was, like, a calligraphy class, for example, where I was just, like, oh, like, a little calligraphy session, and it was near my cousin's house. I ended up asking another friend, but she was, like, my cousin, she saw me post about it, and she was, like, oh, that looks so fun. Let me know if you do that again, and I texted her. I was, like, I was thinking about you, but I was at a brewery, and I was, like, I just wasn't sure if that, like, if that was going to be hard, or I didn't want to, like, put you on a spot or make things difficult. She was, like, honestly, it's a lot easier. Like, I'm good about it now. But she's like, but no, thank you for considering that. Like, because otherwise, it's like towing the line, right? Like, I didn't want to be one of those people who were like, oh, I don't have no reason to hang out if we're not like, and yeah, I was like, oh, I did think of you, but I wasn't sure. And she totally got it. She wasn't like offended or anything. She's like, no, I appreciate that. But like, I'm good. Yeah. Like, I next time, don't worry about it. Like, so yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, it was one of the harder lessons that she learned. But even like, with her friend who she was like in and out of this toxic relationship with this guy who offered her a gummy, and she was like really upset about that. And so it's interesting to see like these different levels of that, right? Sorry, I tell a little bit. Yeah, so Audrey, because
the guy who's sober but offers her a gummy.
Yeah.
I've actually heard that this is sometimes called California sober.
Yeah.
like the California rolling stop, like the California.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I guess there's something about my home state of California, which means not actually the thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I've heard that before because I watched Euphoria. Okay. That was a struggle. I don't know if you've watched Euphoria,
but I've heard a lot of it.
Okay. It's well done and it's like out there, but I really like Zendaya. Mm-hmm. And because she's the main character and she struggles with sobriety, like with drugs, and then she tries to get sober, and they're like, she's just trying to like, she'll try to cover for herself. She's like, oh, I'm just high. And they're like, what, you relapsed? She's like, oh, no, I just smoked a little weed. Or she's like, oh, California's sober. And, like, she said that before. And I just, certain things like that where I'm like, okay, it's like, whatever. I feel like that still wasn't a good choice for her just based on her character. But I think of some people, if that's the whole thing, like where it's just harmless to them and they can still function as an adult and they don't see it as like it's controlling them. Right. Because that's the whole thing. Like with alcoholism, I think, and like a struggle with sobriety, you kind of have to figure out like what role is this playing in my life.
And there's a whole like school of recovery that's all about harm reduction as opposed to total sobriety. There's another great thing about being sober or sober curious now is that there are lots of options. It isn't like we're not in a 12-step only world anymore. There's lots of options. I go to a subscription, the Luckiest Club, which is like I pay an annual subscription and I have unlimited meetings online that I can attend. An unbelievable ride or die friend in those rooms. And I have lots of other contacts and like friends that I've met through that community. And there's others, there's Recovery Dharma. There's just like many at this point. And it's nice because people can find where they fit. And I think I'm not knocking 12 steps. It's helped millions upon millions of people get and stay sober. Yeah. So no, all respect to it. And it's not for everybody. So it's nice that there are options now.
Yeah, and it's because it's rooted in like faith, right? A little bit. And I think I can see how that kind of like turns people
off.
There
are lots of atheists who are true 12-step believers. You can absolutely be an atheist. Like there's this whole, listen, I'm not going to speak with real authority about it because I am not 12-step sober, but my understanding is you can create a God of your understanding. Right. So if you want to be woo woo, you could call it the universe. God is like the universe, or, you know, it could be like the room of people you're in. Right. Like that is God. Right. Like the moment you're in. So there's lots of different ways of understanding it. It's not
Okay. Yeah.
Even though it does use this kind of Christian terminology, there are tons of people who have embraced it and are atheist or not Christian or whatever.
Yeah. Like they weren't really, it's not like they found God, but they found something that they can connect to.
A higher power somehow. Of some kind.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. No, I love that. I love that it works. A lot of people don't have that boundary. Oh, I kind of want to explore like how you brought this. We're going to be spoiler free, but the whole idea of the Phoebe books and how it was like a story within a story. Right. And Audrey was like, oh, you know, that's about sobriety, right? And she was like, oh, like, and so I want to explore your choice of storytelling and how to follow that route and maybe like what role that played into essentially it was like Dawn's quest almost, like her path that she found.
I think whether people realize it or not, most people who have long-term sobriety have joined some kind of community, right? And those communities are almost always based on storytelling. People telling their stories. And by the way, this is not just recovery from, I've come to realize, it's not just recovery from substances. It's recovery from, like, therapy is storytelling recovery. From whatever it is you're trying to recover, whatever trauma you're in therapy to recover from. This word recovery can apply to so many things. It can apply to suicidal ideation. It can apply to self-harm. It can apply to any maladaptive behavior that, that you know, where a person is using maladaptively, just to repeat myself. So I knew that I wanted storytelling to not just be like a theme of the book, but to be like a tangible thing that is happening in the book. Does that make sense? There are a few ways in which that happens. And one way is that there are these snippets at the beginning of every Dawn section from this series of like middle grade young adult books, fantasy books called the Vineland series. And they are by an author who is anonymous. It would be like if the Percy Jackson books or the Harry Potter books were written by an anonymous author. Okay. I don't know how that, in my version of this world, that is a possibility. Okay. So there's this famous and famously anonymous author of these books. And when Dawn hasn't read them, but she gets basically a commission for a job and she has to read the first one. And she reads the first one. She's like, this is my family's vineyard. Like, and mom's not a writer. Like she's not writing on the QT. Like, and she cannot figure out like who it could possibly be. And so she and Audrey go on this quest to find out who is the author of the Vineland novels. And Audrey is interested in these books because, as you just said, she says to Dawn, she's like, I've read all of them. And Dawn is like, you have? And she's like, oh, yeah. Yeah. She's like, everyone in recovery reads them because they're like a parable for sobriety. And Dawn's like, okay. Anyway, and so you have all of this kind of structure around this quest for this author, right? And so at the beginning of each Dawn section, there's a little quote, a little piece from each of the Vineland books. I think there are like six or something. Or the last one is about to come out. So that was like super fun. Actually, I had a document, like a separate document while I was writing the novel.
I was going to say, I was like, did she like come up with a whole nother like narrative story?
I'm never going to write the Vineland novels. That is not.
You should. I'm just kidding.
I don't even want to. I wish I wanted to, honestly, but I don't.
Yeah.
But I did come up with kind of, I had to do some amount of world building in order to come up with what I came up with. And I knew what the overall trajectory of the books was going to be. And they have a lot in common with the Harry Potter books. And because
I was going to say, because that was like a fantasy.
Yes, it's 100%.
And that's like nothing that you've ever tried to do before, right?
Phoebe is the main character in these books. And she goes from like the regular world we all know, which is a little bit of a fairy tale world. And she like walks through the burning vines to the other side, to Vineland. All right. And then so it's like a portal, right? So The vines were a portal. Anyway, and there's a big baddie over there, Morbus, who's doing bad things in Vineland. He must be, they think he needs to be vanquished, but we find out some other things about Morbus. So, yeah.
I thought that was so fun. And that's why I was like, I remember marking it in my notes. I was like, wait, after I saw a couple of the excerpts and how really the role, the place that it was going to be for her in her own journey. I thought that was like, it was fun. It was like a little like, oh, like, wait a second. There's more for me to evaluate and like discover and along with Dawn. Cause when she said like, it's a parable for sobriety. And so I had to go back and like, look at details. Cause like, okay, I see it now. Cause it wasn't like, and it's for like middle schoolers or young children. And plus when we like the information that we find out later, then that just makes it like so much more like meaningful and powerful and like heartfelt. And like, I was just like, oh, dang. Like, oh, cause once we get to know like everything, like other truth of everything comes out. I just remember like my notes become like a little more unhinged on the emotional roller coaster. Cause I was like, wait, what? I was like, oh my God. I was there trying to just like organize my thoughts and keep track of my feelings. Like even if I'm never going to use these notes again, it helps like write it out. And then I can look and I'm like back before I chat with you, I'm just like, oh, this is hilarious. Like, so it was, yeah, that's like were the things I was feeling. Cause it was, yeah, I felt for them. And then it was like, it's like a big reveal and it's not like scandalous, but it's just like, oh my God, like family drama, but also like heartbreaking drama. And it's, yeah. And it's, and I was just like, it's like
I love all of this emoting from you. Cause this is,
yeah.
Writers write anything emotional, right? This is exactly what we hope to hear readers have experienced. So thank you for sharing.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Cause it's just, and I've heard this before too, where people might not remember every like detail or like maybe even a lot of detail about the books that they read, but they'll always remember how it made them feel. And that's like, when I look back, even like 6 months from now, a year from now, I'll look at the title and I'll be like, oh yeah. Like, I'll just like, yeah. Oh. So the thing that I wanted to also explore, like the research involved, cause you must have had to, outside of like your experience that you maybe had to search just to either make it authentic or just learn just for the nature of what Miranda was doing and the family's business and how they approach it and how she, like you said, like she doesn't see it as like alcohol. She sees it as like, oh, this is, there's an art to it. And there's like so many things to learn about it. I learned a lot. Like I love wine, but I learned a lot too. I was like, oh my God, that makes so much sense. I want to explore like your research. And it was everything like that you were fascinated to learn, surprised to learn. Stuff
yeah.
Like that.
Yeah. Okay. So I was approaching this novel that I had to learn about winemaking. I knew a little bit about winemaking.
Yeah.
I was not going to be drinking it. But so the other thing about that though, is I'm not a super science nerd. Like there's a lot of writers who would have really gone deep into the science of winemaking and that's just not my thing. So I really went deeper into like the history of the region. So, and that did really interest me. And who owned this land and how did it change hands? And like, what did that say? And what does that mean? And what does it really mean? One of the things, this was not a surprise in my research, but it was a surprise when I found out about it, maybe, I don't know, 15 years ago or something, which is that there's this pest called phylloxera that can be the end of vineyards. And and there was a phylloxera epidemic. There were a few in the 19th century, the second half of the 19th century in France, in French wine country. And like, it really threatened to like shut down French winemaking. But guess what came to the rescue? California rootstock had evolved to be immune to this pest.
Wow.
What the French wound up doing was taking these California vine roots and planting them in the ground in France and then grafting French varietals on top of this California rootstock, because those vines didn't really produce yummy wine. It produced really like pretty rough wine. It was hardy, like those grapes are super hardy, but it wasn't going to like make a beautiful Pinot Noir. But that is also the way like beautiful California wine is made, right? It is this sort of like really hardy rootstock with these I don't know if we even want to call them French anymore, like French California, these finer varietals with more properties to them to make fine wines are grafted onto this like hardier rootstock. I just thought that was so cool. And like from a historical cultural perspective, and I do say this somewhere in the book, like when there's this point in the novel where Winnie is working on the family vineyard, like as a marketer, like she's writing marketing materials. And when she learns that actually California wine and French wine are like almost the same in terms of like the actual vines, she's like, this is something we should be talking about, because like and this is also a big thing about the kind of California wine history. California wine really until living memory, okay, was regarded as crappy pink table wine, which was not untrue. There was a lot crappy pink table wine being made, like in jugs and boxes. And like, I know that there's good stuff made in boxes now, but like this was the bad stuff that was in boxes. Okay. But all through those years, there was still very fine wine being made, but they had a marketing problem, which was that people who were drinking fine wine only would want to drink French. Like they were like, why would I drink this wine from Napa Valley when I can drink a wine from the Loire Valley? Like, why would I do that? And it was a real marketing campaign to figure out how to convince people to do it. And so one of the ways I think that Winnie kind of homes in on is to like convince people that they are actually drinking French wine, but it's less expensive because we're not importing it on an airplane. The other major thing that happened for California wine was this real event called the Judgment of Paris in 1976, which there's a great movie called Bottle Shock that's made that's loosely based on those events. And it was a competition in Paris, I believe. Yes, Paris, because it was the Judgment of Paris between like, I don't know, five American vineyards and five French in a blind taste test with only like French wine snobs doing the tasting. And guess who won? The California wines all took the first places. So, you know, this was a watershed thing. Like people didn't believe that this could even be true. And that was really when I think, so it was in the mid 70s that California wine really became what we now think of it as, right? Which is.
It's just like the potential, right. Like it has just as much potential to be on the same level.
Right.
Like,
exactly. Yeah. Right. And that it isn't just table wine, right? It is fine wine. Mm-hmm. It's art wine.
Yeah. Yeah. Where it's like almost. I don't know. There are competitions like that with like whiskey and beer and stuff like that. But it's also like, it is like the art of it. Cause if you look at cuisine, like different types of food, like I love that though. I feel like that was just so fun to figure out. Like when you were like, oh, like just the history of it. And then when things like changed, like when that moment, cause it was a big deal to them where they, in the like when your story to like the Hartley Vineyard, like they were like, this is amazing, like, time to celebrate.
This is all in my author's note. The Hartley Vineyard, this is not a real vineyard, right? This is not a real vineyard. It is in a real place, but it's not a real vineyard. But there were California wines in the Judgment of Paris that placed at all different levels. Like they were definitely first in Chardonnay and in Cabernet. But they also placed like third and fifth and seventh.
Amongst like how many, like, cause it was 10 competitors. And then how many wines did they bring?
I cannot remember. I think that they were only allowed to enter one white and one red. And I think it was a Chardonnay and a Cab. It was like, that was it.
Fifth place is like, it's something to talk about.
It really is. And exactly. It's such a cool, it's like, I love an underdog story.
And this is like I think that's just what it's easy to like root for the underdog. It's easy to like, especially like maybe that's how I didn't see them as underdogs, but it's also like they were going through it. They had some tragic past that they weren't, it was like they were trying to keep it quiet, but you could tell it really left scars, like internal scars. And even like, it's like, okay, is it nature versus nurture type of thing? Because it's like some of those traits, those characteristics, it, and something like that does run in the family. Unfortunately, it is genetics, or genetics do play a part, not solely. But yeah, that's one thing that was just like, I don't know. I think I could just like, that's what I thought about, like not only just myself and my own family, but other people too, who may or may not feel a certain way, like about what your characters go through in this book. So I do have just a few more questions before we wrap up, if that's cool. Yep. All right. And then I'll, this is going to be a little bit more fun.
I'm having fun.
Yeah, I know. I am too, but I know like some of it's like heavy, but okay. Let's see. All right. So if we're thinking about, the three women, okay. I'm trying to think, because Lincoln, he was something.
Well, either had a Lincoln or have a friend who had a Lincoln.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. I think I was the one with a Lincoln in college. But anyway. But no, you know what? I don't take that back, that experience, for the world. No. It's part of my life. It's part of my memories, part of my growth, all that. So let's see. How about I'll do the five characters? Gosh. Okay. I'll do five characters. Okay, so if we're thinking about Lincoln and Tom, also among the three women, because I really liked Tom. I know,
everyone loves Tom.
It is just like, oh, he was such a sport about anything that he went through. So yeah, Tom, Lincoln, Dawn, Miranda, and Winnie, amongst them, are you familiar with like the Hot Wings Challenge?
No.
So there's a show called Hot Ones where Sean Evans, he like has like 10 hot sauces ranked from like the least hottest to the most hot. So it's like the 10th is like, you're in pain. You feel like you're in hell. And he's interviewing a celebrity while they're going through these tastings. And so by the end, it's like they can't even answer questions because they're so distracted. Right. They're like not having a great time. So like one through 10, who would like, which one of those five characters would, like, can you rank them? Like, how far would they get? Who would get the farthest?
Oh, you mean with the hot sauce?
Yes.
Does this have something to do with, like, their ability to tolerate pain?
Either that or, like, maybe their competitiveness or, like, their determination.
My gut is telling me Lincoln. We haven't talked very much about Lincoln. Yeah. So Lincoln is Winnie's high school boyfriend. He's a musician. He's all that. And he knows it. But he very much does also love Winnie. Like they have a real thing going, but he has his own stuff that he's working out. But I think that Lincoln, I think, would not admit that his tongue was on fire.
Yeah. Try to play cool. Do you think what he would all make it to 10, or he would just make sure that he was the last one standing?
He would just make sure he's the last one standing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Tom would be like, he would get to 4 and he's like, no.
Why am I doing this?
Like, go. I'd rather give me the guacamole. I need to. And I don't think any of the three women, I actually think, interesting, you didn't put Joan on the list.
I was thinking about it, but I didn't want to put 6 for you to think about. But
Joan would probably get to number 6 and say, this is worthless because you can't taste what's underneath it. If you were to put this on chicken, you would not be able to taste the chicken. So why would I bother? Yeah. I want to taste everything. Because Joan is like the big gourmet, right? And that's something else that's real. That is, I think, fun about the book is how much like food there is in it. Like so much
food to table,
California farm to table, all of that good stuff. Yeah. I grew up in California, so it was really fun to like do all that in this book. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. And then what about Dawn and Miranda and Winnie? Would they just stay at one or they'd be like, I'm fine.
Miranda would get pretty far because she's interested in flavor, right? She might get as far as Joan and be like, okay, I can't taste anything anymore. It's just like my tongue hurts too much. Like I can't.
Like sweating, crying. Like
I think Winnie would be like, Winnie would not make herself uncomfortable. I don't think. She's like, why would I do that to myself? Especially where the book ends. She'd be like, why would I do that to myself?
Yeah, she's taken a little bit. She knows like more about herself and her limits and what she's comfortable with and what she knows that she doesn't need. Like, I don't need to do this. Like, no, I don't need to do this to myself. I don't need to prove anything.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I love that. Okay, so amongst those same, how about we'll do
Okay.
six. Those six character would you go to if you needed to plan a party?
Oh, Joan. Joan, because she would have the best food.
Yeah. She is pretty much like she was like on top of it too. And even like when I love that how you had Winnie find something to do with
Yeah.
her, because they have, and we didn't talk about it either, but they have like a tricky
Yeah.
relationship. And but that was like one thing, because it is, it's kind of like, oh, like it's another aspect of what you're rooting for. It's like, oh, like if they want a good relationship, they should find a way to have a good relationship. I hope that they do. And it was like, and that was like the one thing that they can do together without like Winnie has her job and she knows how to do it. And then Joan is like, yeah, okay, cool. Like, yeah, thank you. And she's fine with delegating, and Winnie's fine with, okay, tell me what to do. What do you need?
Right.
And that was a way. I love that. Okay, so what character would you need to go to if you needed to prep for a first date?
Audrey, we didn't leave her on the Audrey for the first date. Maybe also Dawn would be good for a first date too. Yeah. I don't know. I guess I'm gravitating toward the more modern characters for that because I'm a modern dater. But
Then it's also like it was such a whole different ball game between the what, like the 50
yeah. Oh,
years
you know who would be
or
fun
yeah.
before a date also was Bernard, Uncle Bernie.
Oh yes, the bestie. Oh, I loved
Yeah, the gay
him.
best
He was just
friend.
like, he was so like, he was just so like found
Yes.
family ish, you know, ish. You know, it's like he, and he had her back, and he was, she felt kind of like guilty about some of the things, and he was like, girl, it's okay, like I got you. And I was like, everybody needs a Bernard, definitely. Everybody did. And I'm like, I'm so glad that she had him. And then what character would you need to go to if you had to hide a body?
Miranda. Definitely Miranda.
She'd be efficient.
Yes, she'd
She
be like, we are going to figure this out and no one is going to find out.
I know. It's certain characters where it's like, oh man, I like them. I would love them in my corner. You know what I mean?
yeah,
Like it's,
exactly. Exactly. And I
yeah,
think
that's
Miranda
hilarious.
has just enough, she has a strong moral compass, but if she's going to protect someone, she's all in on that.
Yeah, and that's the choices that they like, they come to a head and they make that choice. That kind of like is a huge plot point. And it was one of those things where you like, you can tell she was struggling with that
Yeah.
too, where she's like, and Winnie kind of was like, I know, I get it. Like she allowed her to make that choice. And it was like, oh, I thought that was like so mature. But then I was like, okay, we got some answers now.
Yeah.
I was like, why? Like, what? Questioned myself. I was like, why? Why did they do with this? It's like, oh, and then it makes it like, it's just like sad again, making me feel feelings. Okay, let's see. Aside from that, just because I'm really curious, it's okay if you haven't really given it much thought. What name would you never use for like a male character or a female character?
I don't have any of those. I'm Winnie, Miranda, and Dawn. I'm very attached to those names. Like they came to me. They were like, this is my name.
I love Winifred. I don't know
I
why,
don't
but
know.
I
Yeah, I've
like,
never known
yeah.
even a Winifred. Like, where did that come from? I don't know. Like, this is where sometimes the writing process is very woo-woo. It's like Winnie was talking to me. Like, she was like, this is my name. But there are other characters who sometimes their names change. Audrey was not always Audrey. She was a Margot. But then I
Yeah.
read, I'm not kidding you, six historical novels set in the 60s where like summer novels where like the best friend was Margot. And I was like, oh, I cannot do that. This is like so
You got,
weird. Like, how did this get into the water? Like, why are we all doing this? So I was like, Audrey is perfect. So I like, but I had to like go to a list.
I was gonna say, because I could see her as a Margot
Yes,
too.
exactly.
Like,
She has
yeah.
Audrey's and Margot's has share some characteristics. Anyway, I'm not a great, but unless like the name really comes to me, I like look up girls who were born in 1962 or whatever
There
the
you
year
go.
was, and
Yeah.
I just look at I never pick from the top 20. I try not to, but then I just go down the list. I'm like, oh yeah, and like it is interesting. I'll look at certain names. I'll be like, nope. Oh, and then I'll be like, oh, maybe. And then I'll keep going. And usually there is one name that kind of like rings the bell. And I will pick, that's the name I will pick. So
Nice.
that's my naming conceit.
Perfect. And then there's like, does it have the same with like a
Yeah, it's
male
exactly the
character?
same.
Or
Exactly the same.
yeah. Yeah, nice. Cool. I know that was like a new question I start to ask, because there's like sometimes the answers are like, I will never use this name. Like they are decided it a long time ago. But then I've had some authors be like, I don't think there's anything off the
Yeah, I don't
table.
think
Like,
anything off the.
so, or you haven't come up to that name that you're like,
Yeah,
absolutely not. And
no.
that's, yeah. You haven't crossed that, or you haven't approached that bridge
No.
yet.
I had a college who was English who told me that I was never allowed to date a Nigel.
But that's like the cliche English
Right.
name
That's, I think that
for
was her
like,
point. It's like, you're not allowed.
that's
I know.
hilarious. I love that,
No,
Nigel. Yeah,
Nigel.
because it's like, oh, Nigel, poor Nigel. Okay, so just a couple more, I promise, because I do like to ask this one. What advice do you have for me? Okay, for the, just talking about those same six, you don't have to give advice to all of them, but individually, who, if you could give them advice, who would you give? Like, what would you
You
say?
know, so I'm getting this question in a bunch of different forms, like asking what advice would you get a young writer? You're asking like what advice would you give to someone early in sobriety? You're asking what advice would I give one of my characters? And I'm going to say the same thing, which is it's what Dory says in Finding Nemo. Just keep swimming. Just
Oh,
swimming.
that's perfect.
Because it's honestly true of everything. It's true, like you just have, if there's something in you that you want, you just have to keep swimming toward it.
Yes, that's, oh, I love that, because I remember my whole thing, like, especially like I came up with it because, like, any people who are having, like, they have a newborn, they have their first
Yes.
kid. And I'm like, the only unsolicited advice I'm gonna give you is one day at a
Yep.
time. Like, just take one day at a time. And I find that can apply to like so
So
many
many
things.
things.
One day at a time, like sobriety, one day at a time. If you're in a marriage, maybe you're learning about yourself and about your partner, new relationship, anything, like one day at a
Yep.
time. A new job, one
Yep.
day
One
at a
day at a time.
time. Going through a loss, like one day at a time. It's so, like,
It's
yeah,
very
again, just keep
universal. Yep.
swimming.
Yep.
Yes. I
100%.
love that. And I think that's why it just like it just rings, it just like people could just remember that so
Yeah.
well. And then like if we got a little tune behind it, like just keep swimming, that like helps
Oh,
people.
you also hear like Dory's voice saying, just keep swimming. Just.
Yeah. Or like
It
Ellen
sounds
DeGeneres if
ludicrous.
you
Like.
want to, like, yeah, because you just you can only, I feel like there's certain like voice actors or celebrities where like you just
Yeah.
hear them. It's funny because it reminds me of like Dot the Dog Man movie. My kids like love the Dog Man books, and then when they made the movie, I was like, yeah, I like going to see a movie,
Too.
the kids
Me
movies with them, because it's pretty, they get it, they want to like entertain the adults too. But Pete Davidson, so his arch, like the Dog Man's arch nemesis is Petey the
Okay.
Cat. And Pete Davidson voiced Petey the Cat. He did a really good job, but like I could only hear him be Davidson. So that's what kind of that reminds me of, where it's just like, oh, do you just gotta, maybe you'll just hear Ellen DeGeneres in your head saying, just keep swimming. Like,
Exactly.
I
Yeah.
love that. Okay, Carrie Mara. So where can we find you online and on
So
social
I do have a
media?
website, carriemara.com, but it's not, it's like, it just tells you about me and my books. If you want to interact with me, the main two places are Instagram, Carrie Mayer Writer. There I am. And you can even DM me. You can tag me, you can DM me. And I have a newsletter that goes out through Substack. Now, you don't have to like, I think there's a lot of confusion about Substack. You do not need to like,
You have to have an
you don't have
account.
to
You
have
can
an
just,
account. You can just,
yeah.
if you go to my website to the contact page, there's like a subscribe thing. All you have to do is give me your email address and you will just get the newsletter. You don't have to
Nice.
like join Substack or whatever. It will function as a newsletter for you.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly.
So that's those.
Perfect. No, because I do follow a handful of authors and
Yeah.
people, and
Yeah, you
yeah,
can. You don't have
you
to.
can. No. Yeah, yeah, it's basically like an
Exactly.
e-newsletter, but
That's exactly
yeah,
right. Yep.
perfect. Okay, so Carrie Mayer, are you working on anything that you could talk about, new
I'm going to be
projects?
very coy and vague, and I'm sorry about that. But I am working on a new novel, and it's about a magical book, and it's an epic love story, and that is all I can say. We're in early
Okay.
stage.
Okay, I love it. My interest
Okay.
has piqued.
There you go.
Okay, so Summer of Love, that comes out on July 7th. Carrie, thank you so much for joining me. Thank you for, yes, perfect. Thank you for being such a good sport and being totally on board with trying out this mocktail demonstration. And the mocktail, it does taste like summer. Yes. Yep. I'm like, this is my second serving because I'm just like, no, like, this is delicious. We can just chill and chat and with our mocktails. I love it. You heard it from my son. He said it was delicious. It was so funny because they were like, they saw me come home with the watermelon and they were like, Mom, can I have some? I'm like, no, this is for a recipe. But now, like, we just made half the batch. And so I was like, okay, now I'm like, okay, do you want more drink or do you just want watermelon? That's fine. Thank you for being flexible and being on board and for doing it. I'm really excited to share your mocktail and your book with the world. I will recommend this for anybody who enjoys historical fiction and also may or may might find comfort in relating to the story, the subject matter. I think it's really important. And I appreciate you being vulnerable and authentic and honest and all that good stuff. Yeah. And if and when you're ready to chat about your next title, next work, feel free to reach out. I'd love to chat again.
Thank you again for having me. I had a great time.
And there you go. That was Carrie Mayer talking about her book, Summer of Love. That book is available now. Check out the show notes where you can find links to find the author online and on social media and where to purchase the book. In the show notes, you'll also see where to find Cantina Book Club on your favorite social media book communities, such as Bookstagram, BookTok, BookTube, Threads, Facebook, and more. And I would love and appreciate it if you could hit that follow or subscribe button so that you never miss out on book reviews and author interviews. If you have any book-loving friends who are looking to get more out of their reading lists, please share Cantina Book Club with them so that they can find upcoming releases and interviews with authors. Another way to help this podcast is to head over to your favorite podcast player and give Cantina Book Club a rating and review. It helps me to reach more potential listeners and fellow book lovers like you. And that goes for any podcast that you listen to. It's one of the easiest things that you could do to help out. If you have any book recommendations, you can reach out to me. I'm always looking forward to providing any suggestions, any genre that you're looking for. If you want in more in-depth book reviews, you can find them at cantinabookclub.com. While you're at it, please subscribe by entering your email on the website so that you could get new reviews and episode posts delivered directly to your inbox. If you want to support Cantina Book Club even more, you can donate by finding the form on cantinabookclub.com. Whether it's a one-time donation or as little as $1 a month, I seriously appreciate the support and will share my appreciation by giving you a shout out on the show. And finally, one of the best ways to help authors promote their works is to head over to Amazon, Goodreads, or wherever you rate your books and give a title you've read a rating and review. It is free. It helps out almost as much as purchasing the book, pre-ordering, shouting on social media, and all of that. Thanks so much for listening and see you next time. Cheers.